Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
One of the most controversial theorists of anti-colonialism, Frantz Fanon inspired a generation of freedom fighters, not least because of his insistence on the need for revolutionary violence. The basic facts of Fanon's life are straightforward. He was born in 1925 in Martinique in the West Indies and died in the United States of leukemia in 1961. In between, he fought for the Free French Army during World War II, studied and practiced psychiatry in France, moved to work in Algeria, then left his hospital post there to commit himself wholeheartedly to the Algerian War of Independence from France. He was also the author of a number of pioneering essays and three books, of which the two most read are The Wretched of the Earth and Black Skin, White Masks.
Come then, comrades. It would be as well to decide at once to change our ways. We must shake off the heavy darkness in which we were plunged and leave it behind. The new day, which is already at hand, must find us
all around
firm,
me, the white man. Above, the sky tears at its navel. The earth rasps under my feet. And there is a white song. A white song. All this whiteness burns me to ashes.
But Fanon's legacy isn't straightforward. His writings were enormously important to 1960s revolutionaries. They influenced Che Guevara in Cuba. They inspired guerrilla movements all over Latin America. They were read like a Bible by the African-American Black Panthers and devoured by left-wing students and radicals in Europe. These days, however, the only place they're studied with any intensity is in the quiet of universities by scholars of post-colonialism. So is the firebrand Frantz Fanon now just a dusty academic subject? Or are his ideas still vital to us? And if so, why?
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, August 4th, 2017. So I have been told. This is our second study session on Frantz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth. We are picking up, really, we're at the beginning of the book because our first session was all Jean-Paul Sartre's preface. So this is our actual first study session where we are getting the words of Frantz Fanon, the translated words of Frantz Fanon. I think that's very important to keep in mind. I think that came up last week, one of our callers in Virginia pointing out I think I even said at the beginning before that, but that we are reading for the first time on the book club a book that was not originally published in English. So we are at the mercy of the translation. Not all translations of this book are the same. That is huge to keep in mind as we proceed. But Frantz Fanon, The Wretched of the Earth, the audio clip you heard at the beginning from the BBC, lots and lots of folks, particularly white people, invest a lot of time talking about the work of Frantz Fanon, and particularly this book, The Wretched of the Earth. Without further ado, we will go ahead and get started. Context of white supremacy, Frantz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth, audio segment number 1.
Concerning violence, national liberation, national renaissance, the restoration of nationhood to the people, commonwealth. Whatever may be the headings used or the new formulas introduced, decolonization is always a violent phenomenon. At whatever level we study it, relationships between individuals, new names for sports clubs, the human admixture at cocktail parties, and the police, on the directing boards of national or private banks. Decolonization is quite simply the replacing of a certain species of men by another species of men. Without any period of transition, there is a total, complete, and absolute substitution. It is true that we could equally well stress the rise of a new nation, the setting up of a new state, its diplomatic relations, and its economic and political trends. But we have precisely chosen to speak of that kind of tabula rasa, which characterizes at the outset all decolonization. Its unusual importance is that it constitutes, from the very first day, the minimum demands of the colonized. To tell the truth, the proof of success lies in a whole social structure being changed from the bottom up. The extraordinary importance of this change is that it is willed, called for, demanded. The need for this change exists in its crude state, impetuous and compelling, in the consciousness and in the lives of the men and women who are colonized. But the possibility of this change is equally experienced in the form of a terrifying future in the consciousness of another species of men and women, the colonizers. Decolonization, which sets out to change the order of the world, is obviously a program of complete disorder. But it cannot come as a result of magical practices, nor of a natural shock, nor of a friendly understanding. Decolonization, as we know, is a historical process. That is to say that it cannot be understood, it cannot become intelligible, nor clear to itself, except in the exact nature that we can discern the movements which give it historical form and content. Decolonization is the meeting of two forces, opposed to each other by their very nature, which in fact owe their originality to that sort of substantification which results from and is nourished by the situation in the colonies. Their first encounter was marked by violence and their existence together, that is to say, the exploitation of the native by the settler, was carried on by dint of a great array of bayonets and cannons. The settler and the native are old acquaintances. In fact, the settler is right when he speaks of knowing them well. For it is the settler who has brought the native into existence and who perpetuates his existence. The settler owes the fact of his very existence, that is to say, his property, to the colonial system. Decolonization never takes place unnoticed, for it influences individuals and modifies them fundamentally. It transforms spectators, crushed with their inessentiality, into privileged actors, with the grandiose glare of history's floodlights upon them. It brings a natural rhythm into existence, introduced by new men, and with it a new language and a new humanity. Decolonization is the veritable creation of new men. But this creation owes nothing of its legitimacy to any supernatural power. The thing which has been colonized becomes man during the same process by which it frees itself. In decolonization, there is, therefore, the need of a complete calling in question of the colonial situation. If we wish to describe it precisely, we might find it in the well-known words, the last shall be first, and the first last. Decolonization is the putting into practice of this sentence. That is why, if we try to describe it, all decolonization is successful. The naked truth of decolonization evokes for us the searing bullets and blood-stained knives which emanate from it. For if the last shall be first, this will only come to pass after a murderous and decisive struggle between the two protagonists. That affirmed intention to place the last at the head of things and to make them climb at a pace, too quickly some say, the well-known steps which characterize an organized society can only triumph if we use all means to turn the scale, including, of course, that of violence. You do not turn any society, however primitive it may be, upside down with such a program if you have not decided from the very beginning, that it is to say, from the actual formulation of that program, to overcome all the obstacles that you will come across in so doing. The native who decides to put the program into practice and to become its moving force is ready for violence at all times. From birth, it is clear to him that this narrow world, strewn with prohibitions, can only be called in question by absolute violence. The colonial world is a world divided into compartments. It is probably unnecessary to recall the existence of native quarters and European quarters, of schools for natives and schools for Europeans. In the same way, we need not recall apartheid in South Africa. Yet, if we examine closely this system of compartments, we will at least be able to reveal the lines of force it implies. This approach to the colonial world, its ordering, and its geographical layout will allow us to mark out the lines on which a decolonized society will be reorganized. The colonial world is a world cut in two. The dividing line. The frontiers are shown by barracks and police stations. In the colonies, it is the policeman and the soldier who are the official. Instituted go-betweens, the spokesman of the settler and his rule of oppression. In capitalist societies, the educational system, whether lay or clerical, the structure of moral reflexes handed down from father to son, the exemplary honesty of workers who are given a medal after 50 years of good and loyal service, and the affection which springs from harmonious relations and good behavior. All these aesthetic expressions of respect for the established order serve to create around the exploited person an atmosphere of submission and of inhibition which lightens the task of policing considerably. In the capitalist countries, a multitude of moral teachers, counselors, and bewilderers separate the exploited from those in power. In the colonial countries, on the contrary, the policeman and the soldier, by their immediate presence and their frequent and direct action, maintain contact with the native and advise him by means of rifle butts and napalm not to budge. It is obvious here that the agents of government speak the language of pure force. The intermediary does not lighten the oppression, nor seek to hide the domination. He shows them up and puts them into practice with the clear conscience of an upholder of the peace. Yet he is the bringer of violence into the home and into the mind of the native. The zone where the natives live is not complementary to the zone inhabited by the settlers. The two zones are opposed, but not in the service of a higher unity. Obedient to the rules of pure Aristotelian logic, they both follow the principle of reciprocal exclusivity. No conciliation is possible, for of the two terms, one is superfluous. The settler's town is a strongly built town, all made of stone and steel. It is a brightly lit town. The streets are covered with asphalt, and the garbage cans swallow all the leavings unseen, unknown, and hardly thought about. The settler's feet are never visible, except perhaps in the sea. But there, you're never close enough to see them. His feet are protected by strong shoes, although the streets of his town are clean and even, with no holes or stones. The settler's town is a well-fed town, an easy-going town. Its belly is always full of good things. The settler's town is a town of white people, of foreigners. The town belonging to the colonized people, or at least the native town, the Negro village, the Medina, the reservation, is a place of ill fame, peopled by men of evil repute. They are born there. It matters little where or how. They die there. It matters not where nor how. It is a world without spaciousness. Men live there on top of each other, and their huts are built one on top of the other. The native town is a hungry town, starved of bread, of meat, of shoes, of coal, of light. The native town is a crouching village, a town on its knees, a town wallowing in the mire. It is a town of niggers and dirty Arabs. The look that the native turns on the settler's town is a look of lust, a look of envy. It expresses his dreams of possession, all manner of possession, to sit at the settler's table, to sleep in the settler's bed, with his wife, if possible. The colonized man is an envious man, and this the settler knows very well. When their glances meet, he ascertains bitterly, always on the defensive. They want to take our place. It is true, for there's no native who does not dream at least one today of setting himself up in the settler's place. This world divided into compartments, this world cut in two, is inhabited by two different species. The originality of the colonial context is that economic reality, inequality, and the immense difference of ways of life never come to mask the human realities. When you examine at close quarters the colonial context, it is evident that what parcels out the world is to begin with the fact of belonging to or not belonging to a given race, a given species. In the colonies, the economic substructure is also a superstructure. The cause is the consequence. You are rich because you are white. You are white because you are rich. This is why Marxist analysis should always be slightly stretched every time we have to do with the colonial problem. Everything up to and including the very nature of pre-capitalist society, so well explained by Marx, must here be thought out again. The serf is in essence different from the knight, but a reference to divine right is necessary to legitimize this statutory difference. In the colonies, the foreigner coming from another country imposed his rule by means of guns and machines. In defiance of his successful transplantation, in spite of his appropriation, the settler still remains a foreigner. It is neither the act of owning factories, nor estates, nor a bank balance which distinguishes the governing classes. The governing race is first and foremost those who come from elsewhere, those who are unlike the original inhabitants, the others. The violence which has ruled over the ordering of the colonial world, which has ceaselessly drummed the rhythm for the destruction of native social forms and broken up without reserve the systems of reference of the economy, the customs of dress and external life, that same violence will be claimed and taken over by the native at the moment when, deciding to embody history in his own person, he surges into the forbidden quarters to wreck the colonial world is henceforward a mental picture of action which is very clear, very easy to understand, and which may be assumed by each one of the individuals which constitute the colonized people. To break up the colonial world does not mean that after the frontiers have been abolished, lines of communication will be set up between the two zones. The destruction of the colonial world is no more and no less than the abolition of one zone, its burial in the depths of the earth, or its expulsion from the country. The natives' challenge to the colonial world is not a rational confrontation of points of view. It is not a treatise on the universal, but the untidy affirmation of an original idea propounded as an absolute. The colonial world is a Manichaean world. It is not enough for the settler to delimit physically, that is to say, with the help of the army and the police force, the place of the native, as if to show the totalitarian character of colonial exploitation, the settler paints the native as a sort of quintessence of evil. Native society is not simply described as a society lacking in values. It is not enough for the colonist to affirm that those values have disappeared from, or still better, never existed in, the colonial world. The native is declared insensible to ethics. He represents not only the absence of values, but also the negation of values. He is, let us dare to admit, the enemy of values, and in this sense, he is the absolute evil. He is the corrosive element, destroying all that comes near him. He is the deforming element, disfiguring all that has to do with beauty or morality. He is the depository of maleficent powers, the unconscious and irretrievable instrument of blind forces. Monsieur Meyer could thus state seriously in the French National Assembly that the Republic must not be prostituted by allowing the Algerian people to become part of it. All values, in fact, are irrevocably poisoned and diseased as soon as they are allowed in contact with the colonized race. The customs of the colonized people, their traditions, their myths, above all their myths, are the very sign of that poverty of spirit and of their constitutional depravity. That is why we must put the DDT, which destroys parasites, the bearer of disease, on the same level as the Christian religion, which wages war on embryonic heresies and instincts and on evil as yet unborn. The recession of yellow fever and the advance of evangelization from part of the same balance sheet. But the triumphant communiques from the missions are in fact a source of information concerning the implantation of foreign influences in the core of the colonized people. I speak of the Christian religion, and no one need be astonished. The church in the colonies is the white people's church, the foreigner's church. She does not call the native to God's ways, but to the ways of the white man, of the master, of the oppressor. And as we know, in this matter, many are called, but few chosen. At times, this Manichaeism goes to its logical conclusion and dehumanizes the native, or to speak plainly, it turns him into an animal. In fact, the terms the settler uses when he mentions the native are zoological terms. He speaks of the yellow man's reptilian motions, of the stink of the native quarter, of breeding swarms, of foulness, of spawn, of gesticulations. When the settler seeks to describe the native fully in exact terms, he constantly refers to the bestiary. The European rarely hits on a picturesque style, but the native, who knows what is in the mind of the settler, guesses at once what he is thinking of. Those hordes of vital statistics, those hysterical masses, those faces bereft of all humanity, those distended bodies which are like nothing on earth, that mob without beginning or end, those children who seem to belong to nobody, that laziness stretched out in the sun, that vegetative rhythm of life, all this forms part of the colonial vocabulary. General de Gaulle speaks of the, quote, the yellow multitudes, and Francois Mauriac of the black, brown, and yellow masses, which soon will be unleashed. The native knows all this, and laughs to himself every time he spots an allusion to the animal world in the other's words. For he knows that he is not an animal, and it is precisely at the moment he realizes humanity that he begins to sharpen the weapons with which he will secure its victory. As soon as the native begins to pull on his moorings and to cause anxiety to the settler, he is handed over to well-meaning souls who, in cultural congresses, point out to him the specificity and wealth of Western values. But every time Western values are mentioned, they produce in the native a sort of stiffening or muscular lockjaw. During the period of decolonization, the native's reason is appealed to. He is offered definite values. He is told frequently that decolonization need not mean regression, and that he must put his trust in qualities which are well tried, solid, and highly esteemed. But it so happens that when the native hears a speech about Western culture, he pulls out his knife, or at least he makes sure it is within reach. The violence with which the supremacy of white values is affirmed, and the aggressiveness which has permeated the victory of these values of the ways of life and of thought of the native, mean that, in revenge, the native laughs in mockery when Western values are mentioned in front of him. In the colonial context, the settler only ends his work of breaking in the native when the latter admits loudly and intelligibly the supremacy of the white man's values. In the period of decolonization, the colonized masses mock at these very values, insult them, and vomit them up. This phenomenon is ordinarily masked because, during the period of decolonization, certain colonized intellectuals have begun a dialogue with the bourgeoisie of the colonist country. During this phase, the indigenous population is discerned only as an indistinct mass. The few native personalities whom the colonist bourgeois have come to know here and there have not sufficient influence on that immediate discernment to give rise to nuances. On the other hand, during the period of liberation, the colonist bourgeoisie looks feverishly for contacts with the elite, and it is with these elite that the familiar dialogue concerning values is carried on. The colonialist bourgeoisie, when it realizes that it is impossible for it to maintain its domination over the colonial countries, decides to carry out a rearguard action with regard to culture, values, techniques, and so on. Now, what we must never forget is that the immense majority of colonized peoples is oblivious to these problems. For a colonized people, the most essential value, because the most concrete, is first and foremost the land. The land which will bring them bread and, above all, dignity. But this dignity has nothing to do with the dignity of the human individual, for that human individual has never heard tell of it. All that the native has seen in his country is that they can freely arrest him, beat him, starve him, and no professor of ethics, no priest has ever come to be beaten in his place, nor to share their bread with him. As far as the native is concerned, morality is very concrete. It is to silence the settler's defiance, to break his flaunting violence in a word, to put him out of the picture. The well-known principle that all men are equal will be illustrated in the colonies from the moment that the native claims that he is the equal of the settler. One step more, and he is ready to fight, to be more than the settler. In fact, he has already decided to eject him and to take his place. As we see it, it is a whole material and moral universe which is breaking up. The intellectual, who for his part has followed the colonialists with regard to the universal abstract, will fight in order that the settler and the native may live together in peace in a new world. But the thing he does not see, precisely because he is permeated by colonialism and all its ways of thinking, is that the settler, from the moment that the colonial context disappears, has no longer any interest in remaining or in coexisting. It is not by chance that even before any negotiation between the Algerian and French governments has taken place, the European minority, which calls itself liberal, has already made its position clear. It demands nothing more nor less than twofold citizenship. By setting themselves apart in an abstract manner, the liberals try to force the settler into taking a very concrete jump into the unknown. Let us admit it. The settler knows perfectly well that no phraseology can be a substitute for reality. Thus, the native discovers that his life, his breath, his beating heart are the same as those of the settler. He finds out that the settler's skin is not of any more value than a native skin. And it must be said that this discovery shakes the world in a very necessary manner. All the new, revolutionary assurance of the native stems from it. For if, in fact, my life is worth as much as the settler's, his glance no longer shrivels me up nor freezes me, and his voice no longer turns me into stone. I am no longer on tenterhooks in his presence. In fact, I don't give a damn for him. Not only does his presence no longer trouble me, but I am already preparing such efficient ambushes for him that soon there will be no way out but that of flight. We have said that the colonial context is characterized by the dichotomy which it imposes upon the whole people. Decolonization unifies that people by the radical decision to remove from it its heterogeneity, and by unifying it on a national, sometimes a racial basis. We know the fierce words of the Senegalese patriots referring to the maneuvers of their president, Senghor. Quote, "We have demanded that the higher post should be given to Africans. And now Senghor is Africanizing the Europeans." End quote. That is to say that the native can clearly see immediately if decolonization has come to pass or not. For his minimum demands are simply that the last shall be first. But the native intellectual brings variants to this petition, and in fact, he seems to have good reasons. Higher civil servants, technicians, specialists, all seem to be needed. Now, the ordinary native interprets these unfair promotions as so many acts of sabotage, and he is often heard to declare, "It wasn't worthwhile, then our becoming independent." In the colonial countries, where real struggle for freedom has taken place, where the blood of the people has flowed, and where the length of the period of armed warfare has favored the backward surge of intellectuals toward bases grounded in the people, we can observe a genuine eradication of the superstructure built by these intellectuals from the bourgeois colonist environment. The colonist bourgeoisie, in its narcissistic dialogue, expounded by the members of its universities, had in fact deeply implanted in the minds of the colonized intellectual that the essential qualities remain eternal in spite of all the blunders men may make. The essential qualities of the West, of course. The native intellectual accepted the cogency of these ideas, and deep down in his brain, you could always find that vigilant sentinel ready to defend the Greco-Latin pedestal. Now it so happens that during the struggle for liberation, at the moment that the native intellectual comes into touch again with his people, this artificial sentinel is turned into dust. All the Mediterranean values, the triumph of the human individual, of clarity and of beauty, become lifeless, colorless knick-knacks. All those speeches seem like collections of dead words. Those values which seem to uplift the soul are revealed as worthless, simply because they have nothing to do with the concrete conflict in which the people is engaged. Individualism is the first to disappear. The native intellectual had learned from his masters that the individual ought to express himself fully. The colonialist bourgeoisie had hammered into the native's mind the idea of a society of individuals where each person shuts himself up in his own subjectivity and whose only wealth is individual thought. Now the native who has the opportunity to return to the people during the struggle for freedom will discover the falseness of this theory. The very forms of organization of the struggle will suggest to him a different vocabulary. Brother, sister, friend. These are words outlawed by the colonialist bourgeoisie, because for them, my brother is my purse. My friend is part of my scheme for getting on. The native intellectual takes part in a sort of auto da fe, in the destruction of all his idols, egoism, recrimination that springs from pride, and the childish stupidity of those who always want to have the last word. Such a colonized intellectual, dusted over by colonial culture, will in the same way discover the substance of village assemblies, the cohesion of people's committees, and the extraordinary fruitfulness of local meetings and groupments. Henceforward, the interest of one will be the interest of all. For in concrete fact, everyone will be discovered by the troops. Everyone will be massacred, or everyone will be saved. The motto, "Look out for yourself," the atheist method of salvation, is in this context forbidden. Self-criticism has been much talked about of late, but few people realize that It is an African institution, whether in the Jemas of Northern Africa or in the meetings of Western Africa. Tradition demands that the quarrels which occur in a village should be settled in public. It is communal self-criticism, of course, and with a note of humor, because everybody is relaxed, and because, in the last resort, we all want the same things. But the more the intellectual imbibes the atmosphere of the people, the more completely he abandons the habits of calculation, of unwanted silence, of mental reservations, and shakes off the spirit of concealment. And it is true that already at that level we can say that the community triumphs, and that it spreads its own light and its own reason. But it so happens sometimes that decolonization occurs in areas which have not been sufficiently shaken by the struggle for liberation, and there may be found those same know-all, smart, wily intellectuals. We find intact in them the manners and forms of thought picked up during their association with the colonialist bourgeoisie. Spoilt children of yesterday's colonialism and of today's national governments, they organize the loot of whatever national resources exist. Without pity, they use today's national distress as a means of getting on through scheming and legal robbery by import-export combines, limited liability companies, gambling on the stock exchange, or unfair promotion. They are insistent in their demands for the nationalization of commerce, that is to say, the reservation of markets and advantageous bargains for nationals only. As far as doctrine is concerned, they proclaim the pressing necessity of nationalizing the robbery of the nation. In this arid phase of national life, the so-called period of austerity, the success of their depredations is swift to call forth the violence and anger of the people. For this same people, poverty-stricken yet independent, comes very quickly to possess a social conscience in the African and international context of today. And this, the petty individuals will quickly learn. In order to assimilate and to experience the oppressor's culture, the native has had to leave certain of his intellectual possessions in pawn. These pledges include his adoption of the forms of thought of the colonialist bourgeoisie. This is very noticeable in the inaptitude of the native intellectual to carry on a two-sided discussion, for he cannot eliminate himself when confronted with an object or an idea. On the other hand, when once he begins to militate among the people, he is struck with wonder and amazement. He is literally disarmed by their good faith and honesty. The danger that will haunt him continually is that of becoming the uncritical mouthpiece of the masses. He becomes a kind of yes-man who nods assent at every word coming from the people, which he interprets as considered judgments. Now, the fellah, the unemployed man, the starving native, do not lay a claim to the truth. They do not say that they represent the truth, for they are the truth. Objectively, the intellectual behaves in this phase like a common opportunist. In fact, he has not stopped maneuvering. There is never any question of his being either rejected or welcomed by the people. What they ask is simply that all resources should be pooled. The inclusion of the native intellectual in the upward surge of the masses will, in this case, be differentiated by a curious cult of detail. That is not to say that the people are hostile to analysis. On the contrary, they like having things explained to them. They are glad to understand a line of argument, and they like to see where they are going. But at the beginning of his association with the people, the native intellectual overstresses details and thereby comes to forget that the defeat of colonialism is the real object of the struggle. Carried away by the multitudinous aspects of the fight, he tends to concentrate on local tasks, performed with enthusiasm, but almost always too solemnly. He fails to see the whole of the movement all the time. He introduces the idea of special disciplines, of specialized functions, of departments within the terrible stone crusher, the fierce mixing machine which a popular revolution is. He is occupied in action on a particular front, and it so happens that he loses sight of the unity of the movement. Thus, if a local defeat is inflicted, he may well be drawn into doubt, and from thence to despair. The people, on the other hand, take their stand from the start on the broad and inclusive positions of bread and the land. How can we obtain the land and bread to eat? And this obstinate point of view of the masses, which may seem shrunken and limited, is in the end the most worthwhile and the most efficient mode of procedure. The problem of truth ought also to be considered. In every age, among the people, truth is the property of the national cause. No absolute verity, no discourse on the purity of the soul, can shake this position. The native replies to the living lie of the colonial situation by an equal falsehood. His dealings with his fellow nationals are open. They are strained and incomprehensible with regard to the settlers. Truth is that which hurries on the breakup of the colonial regime. It is that which promotes the emergence of the nation. It is all that protects the natives and ruins the foreigners. In this colonialist context, there is no truthful behavior, and the good is quite simply that which is evil for them. Thus we see that the primary Manichaeism which governed colonial society is preserved intact during the period of decolonization. That is to say that the settler never ceases to be the enemy, the opponent, the foe that must be overthrown. The oppressor in his own sphere starts the process, a process of domination, of exploitation, and of pillage. And in the other sphere, the coiled, plundered creature, which is the native, provides fodder for the process as best he can, the process which moves uninterruptedly from the banks of the colonial territory to the palaces and the docks of the mother country. In this becalmed zone, the sea has a smooth surface, the palm tree stirs gently in the breeze, the waves lap up against the pebbles, and raw materials are ceaselessly transported, justifying the presence of the settler. And all the while the native, bent double, more dead than alive, exists interminably in an unchanging dream. The settler makes history. His life is an epic, an odyssey. He is the absolute beginning. This land was created by us. He is the unceasing cause. If we leave, all is lost, and the country will go back to the Middle Ages. Over against him, torpid creatures, wasted by fevers, obsessed by ancestral customs, form an almost inorganic background for the innovating dynamism of colonial mercantilism. The settler makes history and is conscious of making it. And because he constantly refers to the history of his mother country, he clearly indicates that he himself is the extension of that mother country. Thus, the history which he writes is not the history of the country which he plunders, but the history of his own nation in regard to all that she skims off, all that she violates and starves. The immobility to which the native is condemned can only be called in question if the native decides to put an end to the history of colonization, the history of pillage, and to bring into existence the history of the nation, the history of decolonization. A world divided into compartments, a motionless, manichaeistic world, a world of statues. The statue of the general who carried out the conquest, the statue of the engineer who built the bridge. A world which is sure of itself, which crushes with its stones the backs flayed by whips. This is the colonial world. The native is a being hemmed in. Apartheid is simply one form of the division into compartments of the colonial world. The first thing which the native learns is to stay in his place and not to go beyond certain limits. This is why the dreams of the native are always of muscular prowess. His dreams are of action and aggression. I dream I am jumping, swimming, running, climbing. I dream that I burst out laughing, that I span a river in one stride, or that I am followed by a flood of motor cars which never catch up with me. During the period of colonization, the native never stops achieving his freedom from 9 in the evening until 6 in the morning. The colonized man will first manifest this aggressiveness which has been deposited in his bones against his own people. This is the period when the niggers beat each other up, and the police and magistrates do not know which way to turn when faced with the astonishing waves of crime in North Africa. We shall see later how this phenomenon shall be judged. When the native is confronted with the colonial order of things, he finds he is in a state of permanent tension. The settler's world is a hostile world which spurns the native, but at the same time it is a world of which he is envious. We have seen that the native never ceases to dream of putting himself in the place of the settler, not of becoming the settler, but of substituting himself for the settler. This hostile world, ponderous and aggressive because it fends off the colonized masses with all the harshness it is capable of, represents not merely a hell from which the swiftest flight possible is desirable, but also a paradise close at hand which is guarded by terrible watchdogs. The native is always on alert, for since he can only make out with difficulty the many symbols of the colonial world, he is never sure whether or not he has crossed the frontier. Confronted with a world ruled by the settler, the native is always presumed guilty. But the native's guilt is never a guilt which he accepts. It is rather a kind of curse, a sort of sword of Damocles, for in his innermost spirit the native admits no accusation. He is overpowered but not tamed. He is treated as an inferior, but he is not convinced of his inferiority. He is patiently waiting until the settler is off his guard to fly at him. The native's muscles are always tensed. You can't say that he is terrorized or even apprehensive. He is in fact ready at a moment's notice to exchange the role of the quarry for that of the hunter. The native is an oppressed person whose permanent dream is to become the persecutor. The symbols of the social order, the police, the bugle calls in the barracks, military parades and the waving flags, are at one and the same time inhibitory, and stimulating, for they do not convey the message. Don't dare to budge. Rather, they cry out, get ready to attack. And in fact, if the native had any tendency to fall asleep and to forget, the settler's hauteur and the settler's anxiety to test the strength of the colonial system would remind him at every turn that the great showdown cannot be put off indefinitely. That impulse to take the settler's place implies a tenacity of muscles the whole time. And in fact, we know that in certain emotional conditions, the presence of an obstacle accentuates the tendency toward motion. The settler-native relationship is a mass relationship. The settler pits brute force against the weight of numbers. He is an exhibitionist. His preoccupation with security makes him remind the native out loud that there he alone is master. The settler keeps alive in the native an anger which he deprives of outlet. The native is trapped in the tight links of the chains of colonialism. But we have seen that inwardly the settler can only achieve a pseudo-petrification. The native's muscular tension finds outlet regularly in bloodthirsty explosions, in tribal warfare, in feuds between septs, and in quarrels between individuals.
Context of White Supremacy. Audio segment number one, Frantz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth. Folks, we are still in the first section concerning violence. For me, this is almost worthless giving out page numbers because there's so many different editions of the book and what have you. For me, we're at the, 53. For me, looks like we're right at the kind of top of, it'd be the first full paragraph of 53. Where individuals are concerned, that's where we'll pick up at for the second audio segment. I'll remind folks, page 53 for me. If you would like to participate, questions, commentary, the number to dial 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you want to join in, but you don't want to use your phone, you can use the free Vote line. It is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tinyty.cc/oneRace. And that is the number one. Address again, tinyty.cc/oneRace. When you put that address in, click the link on the left of the page for the free vote line. When you click that link, it will open a small window on your screen. The first line, it's a drop-down menu. Select the number I just gave out, which again, 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for the code. That code again, 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can press random keys. You can enter a real name, nickname, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. It'll connect you to the program. Same procedure if you would like to participate. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 61. We will see your hand on the switchboard, get you on the line. You can share your views. If you have thoughts, again, this was our unanimous selection to do Wretched of the Earth. So hopefully folks will have interesting insight, questions, commentary. For folks who dialed in, with a hand up. Line should be open. Proceed. See the caller 5771. While we're waiting for the rest of the folks to not spectate, did you have commentary?
I'm sorry, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right, greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. It was interesting. I'm looking at the text, and I guess colonization. I'm just trying to make a rationalization between colonization and white supremacy. I don't know if it's similar or if colonization is a tool of white supremacy, because I'm kind of like looking over the text again and trying to, because I mean, there's a lot of similarities between colonization and white supremacy, you know, in regards to the terrorism and, you know, basically the brainwashing that goes on with white supremacy and colonization. So I'm still trying to make that determination of colonization. I know one distinct thing with colonization is it could be, you know, a particular area that white people are trying to conquer between non-white people. And basically white supremacy, racism is basically across the globe. But, I mean, colonization can happen across the globe as well, since non-white people do outnumber white people on this globe. But in the paragraph, he talks about the settler's town and the colonized town. He talked about how the settler's town is nice and clean and, you know, there's no garbage on the street. And he talked about the colonized town being, you know, run down and, you know, people with no shoes and everything like that. Yeah, I was in Haiti in April, and I was in Port-au-Prince. Now, about a couple of miles from Port-au-Prince is a town called Pétionville, where the white people live at, and where most of the, the travelers or the, you know, people who want to come and visit for a little bit, they go to Pétionville. And Pétionville was so nice, so clean, you know, you see brand new cars and everything like that. But then when you go to Port-au-Prince, which is the biggest city in Haiti, you know, you find garbage all over the floor and, you know, beggars on the street. So I thought about that experience I had in Haiti when I went there. And Haiti basically kind of reminds me of a lot of what Fanon is using as far as colonized, because Haiti is a colonized country. So I thought about that. It was interesting how he made that distinction about in the paragraph where he says, because you are rich, you are white, and while you are white, you are rich. Now, looking at that phrase, it kind of made sense, but then he kind of breaks down on how it needs to be reexamined, because a lot of Marxists like to use that as an example of, you know, even though racism and capitalism is an issue, they like to make capitalism the bigger issue. And he makes a distinction between the two, which I did appreciate, even though he is a Marxist, Frantz Fanon, and, you know, he has Marxist beliefs. He does kind of make a distinction between, you know, capitalism and racism. Muriak, I guess he was talking about Muriak and how he mentioned that he said that of the black, brown, and yellow hordes that will come to invade our shores reminds me of the racist implication of the immigration issue that we've been, you know, having in this country and all over the world. You know, you can't let too many non-white people in this country evoke, you know, and it also reminds me of Camp of the Saints, a book about, you know, I guess, hordes of black and brown people coming over to Europe and taking over and messing up Europe. So, In regards to individualism, he talks about, in the paragraph where he talks about individualism and the colonized intellectual, one of the things that he didn't mention in regards to, and I know he mentioned that the colonized individual, and, you know, to me that's in the sense of, you know, us non-white individuals who are educated within the predominantly white institutions, you know, we're taught individualism. But, you know, the thing about it is that even though they teach us this, white people don't teach that amongst themselves. I mean, white people, they don't, basically they talk like they're individuals, but they're in no way, shape, or form practice individualism amongst themselves. So it is taught with us and it is practiced by us, but with non-white people, they don't practice individualism at all. Even though they preach it, they don't practice it. I got a couple of things, but I'll stop right there and I'll meet my line.
Racism, white supremacy is a collective effort. Absolutely. I did, before we get some of the other folks, I did just want to get in Mr. Fuller's definition for racism, white supremacy, or not his definition rather, but the sentence that he's known for saying, almost infamous at the beginning of both of his books, or all three of his books now. If you don't understand racism, white supremacy, what it is and how it works, everything else that you understand will only confuse you. Yeah, other folks dialed in with a hand up have commentary they want to share. I think Firefighter, did you have commentary, sir?
Greetings, everyone. I was in the process of, because I just, since the word colony, colonization came up, I was going to look it up in the Word Guide. That's what I was doing. That's why I didn't answer at first.
If you want to take some time, that's no problem. We can get to some of the other folks. You can take a minute and gather yourself.
All right.
Okay. Caller 4757, did you have commentary you wanted to share?
Yeah, greetings. This is Universal Alien.
Greetings.
I saw a few quotes in the text that I thought were kind of interesting. In my book, I guess it's page 52, there's a quote, "I dream I am jumping, swimming, running, climbing. I dream I burst out laughing, that I am... that I span a river in one stride." When the native is confronted with the colonial order of things, he finds he is in a state of permanent tension. And another quote, "Natives' muscles are always tensed." It seems like this tension, aggression, or animatedness is something I can identify with in my own experience, being around other victims. And it seems like this sort of restlessness is like, it reminds me of Mr. Fuller's use of the term poison, and perhaps like an unfulfilled desire to solve the problem of racism. And there was another quote that I thought was interesting. "The settler keeps alive in the native an anger which he's deprived of outlet." It seems like I guess a lot of victims, their prowess in sports is an example, in my opinion, of that sort of outlet. Those are my thoughts so far.
Interesting. I had that passage about natives' muscles always being tensed. I had that highlighted as well. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, or I guess while I'm waiting in, since this was a unanimous choice, there should not be lots of silence spectators for this book selection, unanimous choice. Retired firefighter, did you want to take a little bit more time to collect your thoughts?
No, because probably, and it's probably going to, I can say something right now. It's probably going to not end, but I'm almost pretty sure, I could be wrong, but I'm almost pretty sure the word colony, colonialism is going to be through the entirety of the book. So that's what promoted me to kind of like look it up in Mr. Fuller's word guide. And it says, colonialism, colony. Avoid using these terms. When others, I can get some light here. When others use the term, when others use them, ask for a detailed explanation that you can easily understand. Also, do not associate, this is very important right here what he says, do not associate colonialism with racism or, turning the page, white supremacy. Call racism white supremacy and call white supremacy racism. Questions. What exactly is a colony? What exactly is not a colony? Is a colony a person? Is a colony a victim? Is a colony a place? Are all of the people of the known universe who are subject to white supremacy, racism, a colonized people? A race colony? You know, so he brings up some interesting questions on that word, and I concur with him. It's almost like now even without Mr. Fuller's word guide, I could almost sense when some words would be in his book identified as such, put a caution on it, or don't, try to avoid it altogether, because words can confuse people, and they can have the same word with different meanings to it. And so as I'm hearing the book, because I don't have the book, as I'm hearing the book, when I hear that word, I try to identify it with the global system of racism, white supremacy, basically. I think by my understanding of history, and someone can correct me if I'm inaccurate, with my understanding of history, during that time when Mr. Fanon was writing his book, there were still some places that physically had not been where white people hadn't physically went in and definitively said, okay, this is what we're going to do. This is our place. We're going to utilize the land, the people on the land. You're going to work for us. And at the same time, you're going to work for us how? By usurping the resources, and we're going to benefit from it. And because I can recall seeing a documentary that's similar to what I'm hearing, whereas the people were doing so much work for their white oppressors, and these white people were in Europe. They were doing so much work for the white oppressors. It was a place that was called the Congo. And where it was said that most of the Earth's rubber products come from this area, and the non-white black people who were doing all the work didn't even have enough income to buy tires for their own cars, but yet they were forced to tap the trees of rubber. And so I'm pretty sure something similar was the objective in this area at the time, and basically what he was explaining through his first reading is basically how that particular system works. He was explaining on how it works. He was describing, in my opinion, somewhat accurate terms on who the different types of people are. The settlers, the colonists, you know, different people and who they were and what their behaviors are, what they do, what they don't do, you know, that sort of thing. So I can see why this book during the 60s, especially the mid to the late 60s, was quite popular by non-white black people looking for understanding, looking for ideas, because at that time they related somewhat a success story. I'm not saying I did, but I would say they would render somewhat of a success story that took place in Algiers at the time. And they wanted, you know, just like anything else, you know, once you see somebody else being successful doing something, you will want their quote unquote, game plan, you know, and the game plan was one of these books was this particular book that he wrote. And that's all I have to say right now. Thank you. Hopefully I made some sense.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. If other folks have commentary, feel free. I think Gus T will certainly be in a sour mood if the book study continues and folks are spectating, not participating, because, again, this was a unanimous pick. And Gus had said prior to reading that if I had my druthers, we would not have read this book. I've read half this book before. It is not one of my favorites, and nothing about that has changed this time around. Some of the notes that I took thus far, the portion where he talks, for me, this is on 37, it looks like top of 37, where he's talking about the quote-unquote natives, that they are a thing which has been colonized and becoming a man during the same process by which it frees itself. It reminded me somewhat of Mr. Fuller's saying that, you know, non-white people, victims of white supremacy, we are not men and women. We are boys, girls. That's monsters and monstrosities. That's what they have done to us. Let's see. Metaphors, man. I started using, because I have the ebook, I started using different color highlight for metaphors just because they were popping out so feverishly. Reminded me of many other popular commentary on racism of that time period. Just every other line, metaphor, metaphor, metaphor. I don't say that you should not use metaphors. I use metaphors. I just say that we should all be very mindful when people talk about racism and they use a lot of metaphors, whether it's a white person or a non-white person, because a lot of times people are being deceptive through the use of metaphors, and sometimes people are just spreading confusion through the use of metaphors. So really make sure that you understand what's being said when metaphors are employed. He says the naked truth of decolonization evokes for us the searing bullets and bloodstained knives which emanate from it. Passage, just in my view, when you have passages like that, they can be interpreted in a lot of different ways. It's very easy when you have lots and lots of metaphors where you can have people that come up with very different interpretations of a reading, a book, or, you know, a set of writing. He has a passage, and before I even complete this, to give context for this, as someone who is a paid writer, and not just a paid writer, someone who is paid to write specifically about racism, Fanon has a sentence. It reads, in capitalist societies, the educational system, whether lay or clerical, the structure of moral reflexes handed down from father to son, the exemplary honesty of workers who are given a medal after 50 years of good and loyal service, and the affection which springs from harmonious relations and good behavior, all these aesthetic expressions of respect for the established order serve to create around the exploited person an atmosphere of submission and of inhibition, which lightens the task of policing considerably. That is a mammoth 81-word sentence. I will tell you, as a paid writer, there is no way I could get a 81-word sentence through without, whoa, we are going to have to do a re-edit. Maybe you can make this two sentences. Wow, that is, and it's not even just that it's lengthy. It's hard to read really long sentences. As someone who reads books about writing and have done this for years, that is a huge one that they will say over and over again, it's hard, and I don't need a book to tell me that. Reading that sentence, man, that is something they will throw at you on an SAT test, just reading comprehension. Now tell me something about this here sentence. 81 words, and it's tons of them throughout this book. That's one reason right there why I had no interest in reading this book at all. When it comes to racism, efficiency. Part of that is using correct words. When I notice that someone, you start using a lot of metaphors and you're not using accurate terms to describe racism, now I'm going to have to do a lot more thinking to try to guess at what you're saying, what you mean, and just anything. Any book that I hear a lot of white people excited about this book, tons of white people read this book. I can even pause and give you a Frantz Fanon Wretched of the Earth story. I'm talking to a suspected racist who is in a sexual relationship with a white person. We've been talking. I'm giving him my views. Sexual intercourse is incorrect between white people and non-white people. I throw that in along the way on my views on white supremacy. And he says, well, wait, whoa. Fanon was married to a white person. I said, yes, I know that. And it comes through in his work. He says, what do you mean? He did all this work and he fought, you know, in Algiers and blah, blah, blah. I said, yeah, I'm very aware. I've read Fanon. I've read Black Skin, White Mask. I started Wretched of the Earth, which I had years before. I'm very aware of all that. I'm very aware that he married a white woman. And it's clear, in my view, in his work. And I just remember that conversation stood out. And I had many of those conversations over the years with white people. That was one of their go-to works. I'm talking to somebody that I suspect is a white supremacist. And one of your go-to works to try to set me straight in terms of what I'm saying about white supremacy. No. You need to get, brother, Brother Fanon and read Wretched of the Earth and get your mind right. That alone makes me say, wow, I have some suspicions. I need to be very careful with this text and scrutinize it closely. Some of the other things that came through, the passage where he gives all the great detail about what the settler town is like, i.e. white people, and then what the native town is like. Great passage, reminded me a lot of Ta-Nehisi Coates, who mentions Fanon in I forgot the work. We read it on the program. Between the World and Me. He mentions Fanon in that text, and it reminds me of the passage from Ta-Nehisi Coates where he describes all of the effort that black parents put into a childlike detail, going to practice, and just all of the microscopic detail about the abuses of the settler town and what's wrong with it and just what's messed up about it. Great detail, great explicit, not metaphors. Continuing, him, he's a Marxist. Reminded me of Dr. Welsing, where she said she was a Marxist-Leninist. I don't know if anybody had the Welsing moment when I saw that. And she said that one of her relatives, I believe, told her, like, oh, man, the more education they get. Man, and even with this book, he does a lot of critiquing, and I'm accustomed to that. Fanon, he does a lot. There's no VGQ. He does a lot of judging and finger wagging at other non-white people. And the colonized intellectual, that was the question, whatever that means. I'm not even clear on what exactly that term means, a colonized intellectual. Is Frantz Fanon a colonized intellectual? I mean, he's referencing himself as a Marxist, and Jean-Paul Sartre is doing the preface to his book. Like most, I'm sure he's very aware, most of the black people on the planet have not had access to all of the education and reading and scholarship that he has, and he's married to a white woman, unless we might forget. Is he a colonized intellectual? One of the listeners wrote in last week, and they were saying, there was a discussion that he had with Sartre about the preface and him putting together. So, I mean, if you're hobnobbing with some of the most well-known suspected racist white philosophers and intellectuals of the time period, I don't know. That I guess I could put that out to listeners. I'll put it in quotes because I don't know what that term means. It's directly from the text, the colonized intellectual. If you want to throw out a thought or two as to what that term means, and then
if Fanon himself would qualify as a quote-unquote colonized intellectual. Let's see if there's anything else I want to make sure I get in before I yield. Great commentary about the church. He threw in another metaphor. He said that is why we put the DDT, which destroys parasites, the bearers of disease, on the same level as the Christian religion, which wages war on embryonic heresies and instincts and on evil as yet unborn. Another metaphor. Brilliant critique of Christian, the religion of white supremacy. I'll say it that way. Great critique, I thought. Let's see. Last few things I'll get in. We had a reference to another metaphor, and one of my favorites because it's Benjamin Pitchfork Tillman, also from the book club two summers ago. His line, one of my favorites of all time, the sword of Damocles hangs over us. It's the threat of Negro domination hangs over us like the sword of Damocles. Former South Carolina Governor Ben Tillman. Mr. Frantz Fanon uses the same metaphor referencing the sword of Damocles, which I recalled nobody knew what that metaphor meant. I had to explain. Nobody got the joy that I did from reading that because they didn't know what the sword of Damocles is. And Frantz Fanon does and is using it in his work. That's one of his reference points. And for me, that's what I mean. It seems it's reflected in his writing. This looks like something that I think white people would read. This looks like a work that I think a lot of non-white people would struggle reading, given that you have a lot of black people in the States that were denied deliberately access to reading and education for years, and that continues to be the case. I don't think I could go to Ferguson, Mike Brown, and give this book out and say, hey, read this here book. This is going to help us solve our problems, and you're going to get a high level of comprehension with regards to what this means and how I can apply this to what happened to Michael Brown. I could be in error, but I did just the metaphor really quick. Sword of Damocles, where he says, but the native's guilt is never a guilt which he accepts. It is rather a kind of curse, a sort of sword of Damocles, where in his innermost spirit, the native admits no accusation. Definitely the case. And right on time for Michael Brown Jr. Guilty before we even get to anything. Already guilty. And I think I can yield there. That any commentary, I guess, on why this book is so popular with white people, I'll probably ask that for the duration of this text as we're reading it, particularly if people are not participating. I'll be asking that weekly. But why this book is so popular with white people? Do you all think black people would struggle with comprehending this book? Did any of our listeners here struggle with comprehending this text? I'll stop because I feel like I've thrown out a lot of questions. So I'll stop there if anyone wanted to respond.
I would say yes. A lot of non-white black people will struggle with this text, but also at the same time, a lot probably wouldn't admit it. that they would struggle with the text. Sometimes, when information becomes popular. A particular type of information becomes popular. Some people just want to have it around just to have it around because it symbolizes something that they may favor on the surface. So that may be, I'm pretty sure, especially during the mid to late 60s, because the book was so popular, as it was mentioned, I think you ran an article, and they were describing like the Black Panther Party. I'm pretty sure a lot of those young people didn't actually read and comprehend the book, but to have it, in some cases they probably made some of the people buy the book in itself, that sort of thing. So. Because I can recall myself as a member of a quote unquote organization that was a must read book, that one and the other one. and it was a lot that I didn't fully understand about it, specifically because on what you were talking about, because it was so full of metaphors and, you know, that sort of thing, you know, it's hard to comprehend, but I can, you know, just by listening to it in the listening version of reading, and equate it with what I have an understanding of history with, and or my understanding of the system of racist white supremacy, and I can somewhat follow it, you know, but it's no shame on my behalf, though, because if I did know everything about it, then we wouldn't be, it wouldn't be necessary to have a cows program anyway. So those are just some of my thoughts. You asked some other questions too. What were the other ones?
It was a number of why is this book so popular with white people? Do I think black people would struggle reading this book? Did anybody struggle reading the book?
Okay. I can concur that one of the reasons why white people deem it something that they would be interested in is because they know what you said earlier, that this person was married to I won't put the word term married, but was having sex with a white person. And white people have different understandings, not different understandings, but they have layers of how to practice white supremacy. In other words, okay, you're having sex with a white female, so that regardless of whatever else you understand, because of your sexual ties, you basically is not going to really have the time and energy to focus directly on solving the problem. And I can see them actually encouraging non-white people that they say that they're quote unquote friends with, encouraging them to read that book. But one thing I do know, I haven't ever heard a white person encourage a non-white person to read Mr. Fuller's books. I haven't. Now, maybe somebody else has, but I've never heard a white person even mention that much about Neely Fuller, let alone talking about suggesting that they read his books. And I think it's not an irony on why. I think it's a definite reason on why. Between, you know, let's say Franz Fanon's books and let's say Mr. Fuller's information. That's my thought.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Call at 4243-4243.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. This is Red from Ohio. I, again, missed the first segment, so I'll be able to comment more on the second one. But just from what I heard from last week and you, just to kind of answer some of your questions, I know not last week it was the suspected racist writing the preface for the book, but it is definitely difficult for me. I know I struggled because it seems like it's, at least for me, it's kind of like the rising tide of color and, you know, at least with the first part. So I'm definitely going to have more to add once we get to the next segment. But the main thing that I guess to answer the question about why whites would maybe want you to read this book, I'm kind of getting the feeling that, like, the more that I'm trying to learn about racism, white supremacy, and just finding out more, I guess, like black people who seem like they're trying, or non-whites who seem like they're trying to resolve the problem and how they'll be in tragic relationships, I feel like maybe these whites maybe that's their way of course, you know, silencing them or basically guarding them from you know, like what retired firefighters said, you know, really trying to solve the problem. It seems like they, even in like my personal life, if someone seemed like they were really knowledgeable, and then yet, you know, then, you know, here comes this white person to, I feel like, really keep them from reaching their full potential and possibly helping us. So I wouldn't be surprised, just, you know, continuing to listen, if that's the reason why, of course, you know, whites like this book, because they know if he were to get too out of line, like other non-whites, to, I guess, what the word that they would use is radical. If they were to get too radical, they know that there's that white person right there that most of the time in their life, you know, 24/7, their wife, husband, or whatever, to kind of rein them back in and kind of remind them, oh, no, it's not necessarily white people. It's like, you know, like what we discussed on the program before, you know, it's this thing in the room. It's, you know, this invisible hand type of thing. So that's all I wanted to add for now. Thank you for listening.
Sure. I want to insert on page 46, because I know this book pretty well, and had to spend some time studying Fanon, and then I was around other people who were having to study Fanon for their college classes, so I have a little bit more study habits, or a little bit more insight from this reading. So on page 46, decolonizing unifies that people by the radical decision to remove from it its heterogeneity, and by unifying it on a national, sometimes a racial basis. We know the fierce words of Senegalese patriots referring to the maneuvers of their president, Leopold Sédar Senghor. We have demanded that the higher posts should be given to Africans, and now Senghor is Africanizing the Europeans. That was for sure. That is a direct quote. Fanon is quoting, right, from someone who's talking about Leopold Sédar Senghor, who is demanding African posts. This is a Senegalese leader who also married a white woman. And there are pictures where you can see him together. In fact, Leopold Sédar Senghor, Frantz Fanon, I think it's Aimé César, and might be one other writer. They are the founders of a school of thought that is called Negritude. I laugh every time. Two of the three founders of this Negritude movement are married to white people. And it's supposed to be about recognizing the word. But anyway, moving forward, the other question that I had, if anyone had a guess at what the colonized intellectual, what that means, because that was one of the terms, critiques Fanon had of non-white people who've been educated. And does Fanon himself qualify as a colonized intellectual? That was one of the other questions that I posed as well. Did we have any other comments, or folks want to respond to those questions, or anything else people want to get in?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I guess to address the native intellectual, it seems to me that that's sort of like, it reminds me of a sort of tragic mulatto trope. Some of his descriptions of the native intellectual, it seems kind of dramatic, like someone torn between two worlds. So I suspect it could be that some white people might be a bit entertained by those sorts of descriptions. For instance, like there are other descriptions in the book as well. For instance, where he presents, I feel like he might present an image of an Africa on the move at times, a sort of hopeful prospect of the direction that Africa is going in at, I guess, during that period. Some white supremacists might like that sort of narrative because I think it promotes confusion among victims. And one other thing I noticed was that Fanon seems to make a few references to natives as being volatile, potentially violent, those descriptions of like a sort of innate violent tendency might sort of Bifanon identifying with white fears of genetic dominance? Those are some of my theories so far.
Interesting. Thank you for the correction. It is Native Intellectual. Native Intellectual. Thank you. Any other comments or folks wanted to respond to any of the questions that were posed, or if you had your own thoughts? Grand. This book is difficult to read. I wouldn't care if I had like 20 degrees. This book is difficult to read, and that is that I can just go to the raw data. Anytime you have sentences that are 81 words long, that is going to be difficult to read. Now, he says, the Native Intellectual accepted the cogency of these ideas, and deep down in his brain, you could always find a vigilant sentinel ready to defend the Greco-Latin pedestal. Now, it so happens that during the struggle for liberation, at the moment that the Native Intellectual comes into touch again with his people, this artificial sentinel is turned into dust. Reminded me a lot. Dr. Kamal Kamban talked about us having that white traffic cop in mind. I'll have to ask him if he read Wretched of the Earth, if that influenced his thinking in including that as a part of his paradigm, the white traffic cop who kind of polices your thoughts and makes sure you're not doing anything that's going to lead towards eliminating the system of white supremacy. Anything else I wanted to make sure? Again, him being married to a white person like really weighs a lot on me. It's just reading the text because he does do a lot of criticizing other non-white people, in my opinion, not just in this book. This carries over to Black Skin, White Mask, which was published first, but which carries over there as well. I think I can pause here. Or I guess the last comment I'll get in, the passage he says, but it so happens that when the native hears a speech about Western culture, he pulls out his knife, or at least he makes sure it is within reach. Now, that could just be a metaphor, right? This is writing, so he could just be using that in a figurative manner to make a point. He could be talking literally. My general thinking, observation, my conclusion, non-white people at this time period, he was writing this in 1961, and right now, 2017, the bulk of non-white people that I've been around, that is not applicable to. I think we just had the caller who was talking about that instinct of violence. And again, I don't know if he means this literally, or if this is just, you know, we're supposed to take this and kind of as a metaphor. But if I'm thinking of it literally, I don't think that's the case. I think most non-white people, that they have been pretty successfully conditioned to not have any sort of violent response to certainly conversation or dialogue about white people, white supremacy, any of the above. Even I would say out and out explicit talk against black people. It can be vile and pretty degrading. And I think the bulk of non-white people that I've been around, they do not have that, would not be their initial response or instinct is towards violence in terms of dealing with that, at least the people that I've been around. I will, unless folks had any final thoughts they wanted to get in, we'll move to the second audio segment.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
To the question of the colonized intellectual,
Native intellectual.
Yeah, I know. I know in my book it's colonized intellectual, but I think about Carter G. Woodson's book, Miseducation of the Negro, and how he explains how the Negro who was educated in, you know, predominantly white institutions are, you know, conditioned to act like they're part of the, you know, the white establishment, and, you know, how it takes time for them to, you know, uneducate themselves from the, you know, from these predominantly white institutions. And I'm assuming, you know, just my assumption that this is what the colonized intellectual is. And yes, I would probably categorize Frantz Fanon as the same thing, even though, unlike Carter G. Woodson, Carter G. Woodson admits that he was confused in regards to his education process. And also, too, this text, you know, is written in kind of like an academic type of style. And yes, it's a difficult read, you know, and, And I found it difficult even reading it now, even though I read it before. But I mean, obviously, these are texts that's going to take time to kind of like understand them. I mean, like I'm actually reading Dr. Tommy Curry's book, The Man Knot, and you know that's difficult. But I find a lot of good information in that as well. So you know, it's a difficult read, but I think it's still ineffective, productive, and I agree that we should be careful on some of the translations, because this book was not originally written in English. Because one of the things that stood out to me was in one of the paragraphs, I think, because I have a different translation, I think one of the quotes had said, "Get ready to attack." But in my translation, it says, "Get ready to do the right thing." So I'd like put a big question mark on that. I was like, wow, that's a different translation from "get ready to attack" to "get ready to do the right thing." So that's probably one of the reasons why this book is difficult, because it's not originally written in English. So that's all I have. I'll mute my line.
Wow, that is a substantial change. I'm so glad you included that. Which do you know offhand, like which version of the text you have?
It's the one translated by Richard Philcox.
Okay.
And I didn't want to include my commentary on probably why white people like this book, because he has like an 8-page commentary on his translation of the text and how he met Frantz Fanon 3 times. So I'll probably include that in my commentary next week, because I wanted to reread it again and get, because that's a question that I haven't thought about too. Because when you're saying, I do know white people, you know, like to recommend this text, but you know, I was thinking about that, so I'm going to reread this back part again on Richard Philcox's commentary on him translating this text.
Nice. I'd like to read that too. That'll be great. We can include that as we proceed. The caller at 9440, did you have commentary as well?
Yeah, Gus. Good evening, Gus and the rest of the callers. This is Sam out of KC. It's been a while since I've listened to a reading, participated. I had a lot go on, but I'm a younger man, and not a white black male man, and I too have heard this book is like a must read from one to a black people who are older, maybe involved in the civil rights movement or so. Or I did not know. One thing I didn't know is that a lot of whites do recommend this book. I never knew that. Just last week, read up on some of the background on Frantz Fanon and his writing of this book, and I do think it's probably significant that he wrote this book as he was, I believe, I won't say terminally ill, but I guess you could say that, from leukemia. The other book, as you mentioned, I think was it white black face, white mask, or something like that, Gus? I'm sorry, you can correct me if I'm wrong. That book he wasn't ill, but this book he was ill. So I do think that's significant. It is very wordy, as the other callers have mentioned. But I've been intrigued, I guess, so to speak. So you can call it my night, kind of me being a little naive with it, but I definitely listen in more, try to follow as much as I can still. I did not know, though, that he was married to a, or not married, but had some type of relationship with a white person, which I do think is significant. But I don't think, though, that I think a person can still, I'm of the mind that a person can still do some constructive things, so to speak, but I think it is significant, whether born out of a relationship or dealing with a white person. And so that kind of has my ears peaked, because now I am listening and probably try to read this text with that in mind as much as possible. Just from all the commentary, my last comment, in some ways it kind of reminds me, this this struggle, this tug, kind of reminds me of some of W. E. Du Bois, DeVos quotes and his commentary regarding this kind of this pool, but a little bit more him being in Algiers and colonial Africa, there being a little bit more of a racial distinction as far as classes, a more rigid class line. So his is a little bit more rigid than W. E. Du Bois, where it's more like an internal as well as some societal, definitely some strong societal oppression to Black people. But anyway, look at me, I'm getting wordy. But anyway, I appreciate it, and I will continue to listen in and comment. Thanks.
Appreciate that. From the numerous reports that I've seen, France Fanon, he was married to this white woman, Josie Fanon. I've seen her described as a feisty French white woman, whatever that means, but they were not just... they were married. This was not just some idle hookup, according to multiple reports. With that, anybody have any final comment they need to get in before we get to the second audio segment? Grant, we will go ahead and get to second audio segment for me. This is chapter, Gabe, before I said 53, it's actually 54. It'd be the top of 54. And again, it's where individuals are concerned. A positive negation of common sense is evident. That's where it is for me. It'll be roughly somewhere close to that, I would think, depending on the version that you have. We'll go ahead and get started. This is audio segment number two, Frantz Fanon's The Wretched of the Earth, Context of White Supremacy.
Where individuals are concerned, a positive negation of common sense is evident. While the settler or the policeman has the right, the livelong day, to strike the native, to insult him, and to make him crawl to them, you will see the native reaching for his knife at the slightest hostile or aggressive glance cast on him by another native. For the last resort of the native is to defend his personality vis-a-vis his brother. Tribal feuds only serve to perpetuate old grudges buried deep in the memory. By throwing himself with all his force into the vendetta, the native tries to persuade himself that colonialism does not exist, that everything is going on as before, that history continues. Here, on the level of communal organizations, we clearly discern the well-known behavior patterns of avoidance. It is as if plunging into a fraternal bloodbath allowed them to ignore the obstacle and to put off till later the choice, nevertheless inevitable, which opens up the question of armed resistance to colonialism. Thus, collective auto-destruction in a very concrete form is one of the ways in which the native's muscular tension is set free. All these patterns of conduct are those of the death reflex when faced with danger, a suicidal behavior which proves to the settler, whose existence and domination is by them all the more justified, that these men are not reasonable human beings. In the same way, the native manages to bypass the settler. A belief in fatality removes all blame from the oppressor. The cause of misfortunes and of poverty is attributed to God. He is fate. In this way, the individual accepts the disintegration ordained by God, bows down before the settler and his lot, and by a kind of interior restabilization, acquires a stony calm. Meanwhile, however, life goes on, and the native will strengthen the inhibitions which contain his aggressiveness by drawing on the terrifying myths which are so frequently found in underdeveloped communities. There are maleficent spirits which intervene every time a step is taken in the wrong direction. Leopard men, serpent men, six-legged dogs, zombies, a whole series of tiny animals or giants, which create around the native a world of prohibitions, of barriers, and of inhibitions for far more terrifying than the world of the settler. This magical superstructure, which permeates native society, fulfills certain well-defined functions in the dynamism of the libido. One of the characteristics of underdeveloped societies is, in fact, that the libido is first and foremost the concern of a group or of the family. The feature of communities whereby a man who dreams that he has sexual relations with a woman other than his own must confess it in public and pay fine in kind or in working days to the injured husband or family is fully described by ethnologists. We may note in passing that this proves that the so-called prehistoric societies attach great importance to the unconscious. The atmosphere of myth and magic frightens me and so takes on an undoubted reality. By terrifying me, it integrates me in the traditions and the history of my district or of my tribe. And at the same time, it reassures me. It gives me a status, as it were, an identification paper. In underdeveloped countries, the occult sphere is a sphere belonging to the community, which is entirely under magical jurisdiction. By entangling myself in this inextricable network where actions are repeated with crystalline inevitability, I find the everlasting world which belongs to me, and the perennality which is thereby affirmed of the world belonging to us. Believe me, the zombies are more terrifying than the settlers, and in consequence, the problem is no longer that of keeping oneself right with the colonial world and its barbed wire entanglements, but of considering three times before urinating, spitting, or going out into the night. The supernatural, magical powers reveal themselves as essentially personal. The settlers' powers are infinitely shrunken, stamped with their alien origin. We no longer really need to fight against them, since what counts is the frightening enemy created by myths. We perceive that all is settled by permanent confrontation on the phantasmic plane. It has always happened in the struggle for freedom that such a people, formerly lost in an imaginary maze, a prey to unspeakable terrors, yet happy to lose themselves in a dreamlike torment, such a people becomes unhinged, reorganizes itself, and in blood and tears gives birth to very real and immediate action. Feeding the mujahideens, posting sentinels, coming to the help of families which lack the bare necessities, or taking the place of a husband who has been killed or imprisoned, such are the concrete tasks to which the people is called during the struggle for freedom. In the colonial world, the emotional sensitivity of the native is kept on the surface of his skin, like an open sore which flinches from the caustic agent, and the psyche shrinks back, obliterates itself, and finds outlet in muscular demonstrations which have caused certain very wise men to say that the native is a hysterical type. The sensitive emotionalism, watched by invisible keepers, who are, however, in unbroken contact with the core of the personality, will find its fulfillment through eroticism in the driving forces behind the crisis, dissolution. On another level, we see the native's emotional sensibility exhausting itself in dances which are more or less ecstatic. This is why any study of the colonial world should take into consideration the phenomena of the dance and of possession. The native's relaxation takes precisely the form of a muscular orgy in which the most acute aggressivity and the most impelling violence are canalized, transformed, and conjured away. The circle of the dance is a permissive circle. It protects and permits. At certain times on certain days, men and women come together at a given place and there, under the solemn eye of the tribe, fling themselves into a seemingly unorganized pantomime, which is in reality extremely systematic, and which by various means, shakes of the head, bending of the spinal column, throwing of the whole body backward, may be deciphered as in an open book the huge effort of a community to exercise itself, to liberate itself, to explain itself. There are no limits inside the circle. The hillock, up which you have toiled, as if to be nearer to the moon, the river bank down which you slip, as if to show the connection between the dance and ablutions, cleansing and purification, these are sacred places. There are no limits, for in reality your purpose in coming together is to allow the accumulated libido, the hampered aggressivity, to dissolve as in a volcanic eruption. Symbolical killings, fantastic rides, imaginary mass murders, all must be brought out. The evil humors are undammed and flow away with a din as of molten lava. One step further and you are completely possessed. In fact, these are actually organized seances of possession and exorcism. They include vampirism, possession by jains, by zombies, and by Legba, the famous god of the voodoo. This disintegrating of the personality, this splitting and dissolution, all this fulfills a primordial function in the organism of the colonial world. When they set out, the men and women were impatient, stamping their feet in a state of nervous excitement. When they return, peace has been restored to the village. It is once more calm and unmoved. During the struggle for freedom, a marked alienation from these practices is observed. The native's back is to the wall. The knife is at his throat, or more precisely, the electrode at his genitals. He will have no more call for his fancies. After centuries of unreality, after having wallowed in the most outlandish phantoms, at long last, the native, gun in hand, stands face to face with the only forces which contend for his life, the forces of colonialism. And the youth of a colonized country, growing up in an atmosphere of shot and fire, may well make a mock of and does not hesitate to pour scorn upon the zombies of his ancestors, the horses with two heads, the dead who rise again, and the genies who rush into your body while you yawn. The native discovers reality and transforms it into the pattern of his customs, into the practice of violence, and into his plan for freedom. We have seen that this same violence, though kept very much on the surface all through the colonial period, yet turns in the void. We have also seen that it is canalized by the emotional outlets of dance and possession by spirits. We have seen how it is exhausted in fratricidal combats. Now the problem is to lay hold of this violence, which is changing direction. When formerly it was appeased by myths and exercises talents in finding fresh ways of committing mass suicide, now new conditions will make possible a completely new line of action. Nowadays, a theoretical problem of prime importance is being set on the historical plane as well as on the level of political tactics. By the liberation of the colonies, when can one affirm that the situation is ripe for a movement of national liberalization? In what form should it first be manifested? Because the various means whereby decolonization has been carried out have appeared in many different aspects. Reason hesitates and refuses to say which is a true decolonization and which is a false. We shall see that for a man who is in the thick of the fight, it is an urgent matter to decide on the means and the tactics to employ, that is to say, how to conduct and organize the movement. If this coherence is not present, there is only a blind will toward freedom, with the terribly reactionary risk which it entails. What are the forces which in the colonial period open up new outlets and engender new aims for the violence of colonized peoples? In the first place, there are the political parties and the intellectual or commercial elites. Now, the characteristic feature of certain political structures is that they proclaim abstract principles but refrain from issuing definite commands. The entire action of these nationalist political parties during the colonial period is action of the electoral type, a string of philosophical political dissertations on the themes of the rights of peoples to self-determination, the rights of man to freedom from hunger and human dignity, and the unceasing affirmation of the principle, one man, one vote. The national political parties never lay stress upon the necessity of a trial of armed strength, for the good reason that their objective is not the radical overthrowing of the system. Pacifists and legalists, they are in fact partisans of order, the new order. But to the colonialist bourgeoisie, they put bluntly enough the demand which is to them the main one. Give us more power. On the specific question of violence, the elite are ambiguous. They are violent in their words and reformist in their attitudes. When the nationalist political leaders say something, they make quite clear that they do not really think it. This characteristic on the part of the nationalist political parties should be interpreted in the light both of the makeup of their leaders and the nature of their followings. The rank and file of a nationalist party is urban. The workers, primary school teachers, artisans, and small shopkeepers who have begun to profit, at a discount, to be sure, from the colonial setup, have special interest at heart. What this sort of following demands is the betterment of their particular lot, increased salaries, for example. The dialogue between these political parties and colonialism is never broken off. Improvements are discussed, such as full electoral representation, the liberty of the press, and liberty of association. Reforms are debated. Thus, it need not astonish anyone to notice that a large number of natives are militant members of the branches of political parties which stem from the mother country. These natives fight under an abstract watchword, government by the workers, and they forget that in their country it should be nationalist watchwords which are first in the field. The native intellectual has clothed his aggressiveness in his barely veiled desire to assimilate himself to the colonial world. He has used his aggressiveness to serve his own individual interests. Thus, there is very easily brought into being a kind of class of affranchised slaves, or slaves who are individually free. What the intellectual demands is the right to multiply the emancipated and the opportunity to organize a genuine class of emancipated citizens. On the other hand, the mass of the people have no intention of standing by and watching individuals increase their chances of success. What they demand is not the settler's portion of status, but the settler's place. The immense majority of natives want the settler's farm. For them, there's no question of entering into competition with the settler. They want to take his place. The peasantry is systematically disregarded, for the most part, by the propaganda put out by the nationalist parties. And it is clear that in the colonial countries, the peasants alone are revolutionary, for they have nothing to lose and everything to gain. The starving peasant, outside the class system, is the first among the exploited to discover that only violence pays. For him, there is no compromise, no possible coming to terms. Colonization and decolonization are simply a question of relative strength. The exploited man sees that his liberation implies the use of all means, and that of force first and foremost. When, in 1956, after the capitulation of Mansour Guy Mollé to the settlers in Algeria, the Front de Libération Nationale, in a famous leaflet, stated that colonialism only loosens its hold when the knife is at its throat. No Algerian really found these terms too violent. The leaflet only expressed what every Algerian felt at heart. Colonialism is not a thinking machine, nor a body endowed with reasoning faculties. It is violence in its natural state, and it will only yield when confronted with greater violence. At the decisive moment, the colonialist bourgeoisie, which up till then has remained inactive, comes into the field. It introduces that new idea which is in paper parlance a creation of the colonial situation, nonviolence. In its simplest form, this nonviolence signifies to the intellectual and economic elite of the colonized country that the bourgeoisie has the same interest as they, and that it is therefore urgent and indispensable to come to terms for the public good. Nonviolence is an attempt to settle the colonial problem around a green baize table before any regrettable act has been performed or irreparable gesture made, before any blood has been shed. But if the masses, without waiting for the chairs to be arranged around the baize table, listen to their own voice and begin committing outrages and setting fire to buildings, the elite and the nationalist bourgeoisie parties will be seen rushing to the colonists to exclaim, "This is very serious. We do not know how it will end. We must find a solution, some sort of compromise." This idea of compromise is very important in the phenomenon of decolonization, for it is very far from being a simple one. Compromise involves the colonial system, and the young nationalist bourgeoisie at one and the same time. The partisans of the colonial system discover that the masses may destroy everything: blown up bridges, ravaged farms, repressions, and fighting harshly disrupt the economy. Compromise is equally attractive to the nationalist bourgeoisie, who, since they are not clearly aware of the possible consequences of the rising storm, are genuinely afraid of being swept away by this huge hurricane, and never stop saying to the settlers, "We are still capable of stopping the slaughter. The masses still have confidence in us. Act quickly if you do not want to put everything in jeopardy." One step more, and the leader of the Nationalist Party keeps his distance with regard to that violence. He loudly proclaims that he has nothing to do with these Mau Mau, these terrorists, these throat slitters. At best, he shuts himself off in a no-man's land between the terrorists and the settlers and willingly offers his services as go-between. That is to say, that as the settlers cannot discuss terms with these Mau Mau, he himself will be quite willing to begin negotiations. Thus, it is that the rear guard of the national struggle, that very party of people who have never ceased to be on the other side in the fight, find themselves somersaulted into the van of negotiations and compromise, precisely because that party has taken very good care never to break contact with colonialism. Before negotiations have been set afoot, the majority of nationalist parties confine themselves, for the most part, to explaining and excusing this savagery. They do not assert that the people have to use physical force, and it sometimes even happens that they go so far as to condemn in private the spectacular deeds which are declared to be hateful by the press and public opinion in the mother country. The legitimate excuse for this ultra-conservative policy is the desire to see things in an objective light. But this traditional attitude of the native intellectual and of the leaders of the nationalist parties is not, in reality, in the least objective. For in fact, they are not at all convinced that this impatient violence of the masses is the most efficient means of defending their own interests. Moreover, there are some individuals who are convinced of the ineffectiveness of violent methods. For them, there is no doubt about it. Every attempt to break colonial oppression by force is a hopeless effort, an attempt at suicide, because in the innermost recesses of their brains, the settlers' tanks and airplanes occupy a huge place. When they are told action must be taken, they see bombs raining down on them, armored cars coming at them on every path, machine gunning and police action, and they sit quiet. They are beaten from the start. There is no need to demonstrate their incapacity to triumph by violent methods. They take it for granted in their everyday life and in their political maneuvers. They have remained in the same childish position as Engels took up in his famous polemic with that monument of puerility, Monsieur Doring. In the same way that Robinson Crusoe was able to obtain a sword, we can just as well suppose that Friday might appear one fine morning with a loaded revolver in his hand, and from then on the whole relationship of violence is reversed. Man Friday gives the orders, and Crusoe is obliged to work. Thus, the revolver triumphs over the sword, and even the most childish believer in axioms will doubtless form the conclusion that violence is not a simple act of will, but needs for its realization certain very concrete preliminary conditions, and in particular the implements of violence. And the more highly developed of these implements will carry the day against primitive ones. Moreover, the very fact of the ability to produce such weapons signifies that the producer of highly developed weapons in everyday speech, the arms manufacturer, triumphs over the producer of primitive weapons. To put it briefly, the triumph of violence depends upon the production of armaments, and this, in its turn, depends on production in general, and thus on economic strength and on the economy of the state, and in the last resort, on the material means which that violence commands. In fact, the leaders of reform have nothing else to say than, with what are you going to fight the settlers? with your knives, your shotguns? It is true that weapons are important when violence comes into play, since all finally depends on the distribution of these implements. But it so happens that the liberation of colonial countries throws new light on the subject. For example, we have seen that during the Spanish campaign, which was a very genuine colonial war, Napoleon, in spite of an army which reached in the offensives of the spring of 1810 the huge figure of 400,000 men, was forced to retreat. Yet the French army made the whole of Europe tremble by its weapons of war, by the bravery of its soldiers, and by the military genius of its leaders. Face to face with the enormous potentials of the Napoleonic troops, the Spaniards, inspired by an unshakable national ardor, rediscovered the famous methods of guerrilla warfare which, 25 years before, the American militia had tried out on the English forces. But the natives' guerrilla warfare would be of no value, as opposed to other means of violence, if it did not form a new element in the worldwide process of competition between trusts and monopolies. In the early days of colonization, a single column could occupy immense stretches of a country, the Congo, Nigeria, the Ivory Coast, and so on. Today, however, the colonized country's national struggle crops up in a completely new international situation. Capitalism, in its early days, saw in the colonies a source of raw materials which, once turned into manufactured goods, could be distributed on the European market. After a phase of accumulation of capital, capitalism has today come to modify its conception of the profit-earning capacity of a commercial enterprise. The colonies have become a market. The colonial population is a customer who is ready to buy goods. Consequently, if the garrison has to be perpetually reinforced, if buying and selling slackens off, that is to say, if manufactured and finished goods can no longer be exported, there is clear proof that the solution of military force must be set aside. A blind domination founded on slavery is not, economically speaking, worthwhile for the bourgeoisie of the mother country. The monopolistic group within this bourgeoisie does not support a government whose policy is solely that of the sword. What the factory owners and finance magnates of the mother country expect from their government is not that it should decimate the colonial peoples, but that it should safeguard, with the help of economic conventions, their own, quote, legitimate interest, end quote. Thus, there exists a sort of detached complicity between capitalism and the violent forces which blaze up in colonial territory. What is more, the native is not alone against the oppressor, for indeed there is also the political and diplomatic support of progressive countries and peoples. But above all, there is competition. That pitiless war which financial groups wage upon each other. A Berlin conference was able to tear Africa into shreds and divide her up between three or four imperial flags. At the moment, the important thing is not whether such and such a region in Africa is under French or Belgian sovereignty, but rather that the economic zones are respected. Today, wars of repression are no longer waged against rebel sultans. Everything is more elegant, less bloodthirsty. The liquidation of the Castro regime will be quite peaceful. They do all they can do to strangle Guyana, and they eliminate Masedega. Thus, the national leader who is frightened of violence is wrong if he imagines that colonialism is going to massacre all of us. The military will, of course, go on playing with the tin soldiers, which date from the time of the conquest, but higher finance will soon bring the truth home to them. This is why reasonable nationalist political parties are asked to set out their claims as clearly as possible and to seek with their colonialist opposite numbers, calmly and without passion, for a solution which will take the interest of both parties into consideration. We see that if this nationalist reformist tendency, which often takes the form of a kind of caricature of trade unionism, decides to take action, it would only do so in a highly peaceful fashion, through stoppages of work in the few industries which have been set up in the towns, mass demonstrations to cheer the leaders, and the boycotting of buses or of imported commodities. All these forms of action serve at one and the same time to bring pressure to bear on the forces of colonialism and to allow the people to work off their energy. This practice of therapy by hibernation, this sleep cure used on the people, may sometimes be successful. Thus, out of the conference around the green beige table comes the political selectiveness which enables Monsieur Emba, the President of the Republic of Gabon, to state in all seriousness on his arrival in Paris for an official visit, "Gabon is independent, but between Gabon and France, nothing has changed. Everything goes on as before. In fact, the only change is that Monsieur Emba is President of the Gabonese Republic, and that he is received by the President of the French Republic." The colonialist bourgeoisie is helped in its work of calming down the natives by the inevitable religion. All those saints who have turned the other cheek, who have forgiven trespasses against them, and who have been spat on and insulted without shrinking, and studied and held up as examples. On the other hand, the elite of the colonial countries, those slaves set free, when at the head of the movement, inevitably end up by producing an ersatz conflict. They use their brother slavery to shame the slave drivers or to provide an ideological policy of quaint humanitarianism for their oppressors' financial competitors. The truth is that they never make any real appeal to the aforesaid slaves. They never mobilize them in concrete terms. On the contrary, at the decisive moment, that is to say, from their point of view, the moment of indecision, they brandish the danger of a, quote, mass mobilization, as the crucial weapon which would bring about, as if by magic, the end of the colonial regime. Obviously, there are to be found at the core of the political parties and among their leaders certain revolutionaries who deliberately turn their backs upon the farce of national independence. But very quickly, their questionings, their energy, and their anger obstruct the party machine, and these elements are gradually isolated and then, quite simply, brushed aside. At this moment, as if there existed a dialectic concomitance, the colonialist police will fall upon them, with no security in the towns, avoided by the militants of their former party and rejected by its leaders. These undesirable firebrands will be stranded in county districts. Then it is that they will realize, bewilderedly, that the peasant masses catch on to what they have to say immediately, and without delay ask them the question to which they have not yet prepared the answer. when do we start?
Context of white supremacy that will wrap us for today. We'll pick up there next week. For me, we are at like the very top of page 68. Very top of 68 for the version that I have. If you have commentary you would like to share, the number 641-715-3460. Number again, 641-715-3640. If you have commentary you would like to share, feel free. All the folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed. Did folks have any comments from the second audio segment, or nothing in particular stood out?
I'm still gathering my thoughts. It'll be just a minute.
Gather. Take your time. That is not a problem. While folks are thinking, I did take a few notes I will share as we proceed. Let's see. I took fewer notes during the second section, although I did still take, I guess I did take a few things down. Let's see. I'm making sure I don't go too far back. Okay, these are the things I picked up from the second portion. So, in the colonial world, the emotional sensitivity of the native is kept on the surface of his skin like an open sore, which flinches from the caustic agent, and the psyche shrinks back, obliterates itself, and finds outlet in muscular demonstrations, which have caused certain very wise men to say that the native is a hysterical type. That's all one sentence right there. That's about another 60-word sentence. This sensitive emotionalism watched by invisible keepers who are, however, in unbroken contact with the core of the personality will find its fulfillment through eroticism in the driving forces behind the crisis dissolution. This is really, really difficult to read. I think Dr. Tommy Curry's book was mentioned, The Man Knot. That book is difficult to read as well. And I have, in speaking with Dr. Curry on this program, asked him to lower his vocabulary, because I do think at times as well, I think it would be difficult for someone who has not had some academic training, spent a lot of time in school, to understand what he has to say. But this is substantially more difficult than Dr. Curry's work. He generally doesn't have lots and lots of metaphors. Every other sentence, a lot of time he'll have just data to kind of ground a point here or there to make sure that you're understanding what's being discussed. I'd say this is significantly more challenging to read. But in the portion that I just read, I did think it was very significant where these accusations of non-white people being really emotional, those types of charges are on a regular basis, I think, where he says even being referred to as being hysterical, the hysterical type. I think that's common worldwide. I also thought towards the end of that, where he says my page is broken, so that's why I'm having a hard time. So it's the sensitive emotionalism watched by invisible keepers, whites, who are, however, in unbroken contact with the core of the personality will find its fulfillment through eroticism. In my view, that's some sort of tragic arrangement, sexual exploitation in the driving forces behind the crisis dissolution. Very difficult to kind of unpack in all of this, but at least from my view, these charges of black people or non-white people being hyper emotional and really sensitive, that there's some sort of, I guess, maybe unannounced hidden sexual desire for black people, particularly, I think, when you in a time where it's lots of these challenges against racism, white supremacy, 1960s times that he was writing this book, even the time that he wrote Black Skin, White Mask, which pretty much, I mean, that's major theme of the whole book, that little paragraph that I just read, or a couple sentences that I just read right there. One of the other passages that I highlighted, let's see, from this one, a little further down on the same page, where he talks about the times when black people are just go out and dance, and or I guess all of the aggression that they have as a result that's pent up from racism, white supremacy. I thought that accurately described a lot of the club activity and hip hop music activity, or what's called hip hop music. And when he says there are no limits inside the circle, reminded me that was talked about on Solange's most recent album. I think she had Master P on talking about the origins of No Limit Records and what have you. But that, I think that probably stands for a lot of the activities that we carry out worldwide, looking for ways to release the frustration and energy that we have as a result of racism, white supremacy. Next thing that stood out, the native's back is to the wall, the knife is at his throat, or more precisely, the electrode at his genitals. He will have no more call for his fancies. One time we get a pretty short to the point sentence, certainly Dr. Welsing moment accurate. It's not that I think Fanon did not have accurate points. I think he does. It's just that I think it's in a lot of very difficult verbiage, and I also think it veers off into a lot of critiquing non-white people. As I said, that's a pattern that I've pointed out in this book. I pointed it out in Black Skin, White Mask. In fact, the passage, this is at kind of the bottom of 62. I think some of this goes into 63, where he's kind of criticizing non-white people who say they don't want to fight racist man, racist woman, racist child. They've got all this firepower and what have you. I'm afraid. The bombs, in fact, he says in the passage, when they are told action must be taken, they see bombs raining down on them, armored cars coming at them on every path, machine gunning and police action, and they sit quiet. They are beaten from the start. There is no need to demonstrate their incapacity to triumph by violent methods. They take it for granted in their everyday life and in their political maneuvers. They have remained in the same childish position as Ingalls took up in his famous polemic with that monument of puerility, Mansour Durin. I'm pausing just because this is again where he's pulling in reference. His reference points are white culture, white literature, the Sword of Damocles, Frederick Ingalls, Karl Marx, Robinson Crusoe. All of his reference points are from white culture, white literature. It's as though he is writing to white people and what their frame of reference points will be as they're reading this book. Continuing, he says, in the same way Robinson Crusoe was able to obtain a sword, we can just as well suppose that Man Friday might appear one fine morning with a loaded revolver in his hand, and from the whole relationship on, a violence is reversed. For me, when we're going into metaphors, talking about violence and racism, and we're weaving in and out of metaphors, weaving in and out of fictional stories, as I understand it, Robinson Crusoe, this is fiction, as I understand it. You all can correct me if I'm in error. But we're weaving in and out of that. It just makes it very difficult. If we're talking about counter violence, I want to know that we're serious, and I want to be talking in explicit details, not fantasy and different metaphors and what have you, where I'm having to make sure I'm understanding. If I haven't read these books, I might not know what you're talking about at all. And I'm sure a lot of black people have not read these books, even at that time period, have not read these books and don't know these references. And just to me, this sounded a lot like rhetoric I've heard before when black people criticize another black person who says, I'm afraid of white people. You're right. I've seen what they've done. I've seen the lynchings. I've seen the bombs. I've seen the police chokings and beatings and everything else. I'm scared of white people. I don't want any part of them. And the person responds, you know, good scaredy cat coon. That's exactly why we lose. We got no good Tom coon chickens like you. That's why we lose. That's exactly what it sounds like. I've heard this rhetoric, you know, criticizing black people before. Now, he does go on to say just a few sentences down that, you know, weapons are important and, you know, having an accurate understanding of logistics in battle. But that sort of critiquing of other black people is very, very popular even right now, 2017. And I've not seen where it solves any problems, just to shake your finger at another black person who is logically afraid of centuries of white terrorism, particularly to hear that type of critique from someone who's buried to a white person. I'll stop there. Did any of the folks who had a hand up, did you all have commentary that you wanted to share?
Can I be may heard? I be heard?
I'm sorry.
You can go ahead.
Right on.
Okay. Thank you. The couple of things that I wanted to point out. I'm also reading like the PDF online. It's from a website called Abali. I'm not sure how to say it. It's ABAHALAIL.org. It's the same exact as the audio. And on, it says page 53. It kind of stuck out to me that he uses the term zombies a lot, where he says, now I lost it again. Actually, that's not the one where he uses zombies, but it's he's basically saying by throwing himself with all of his force into the vendetta, the native tries to persuade himself that colonialism doesn't exist, that everything is going on as before, that history continues. And I think that kind of points to the denial that before we try to learn more as non-whites, denial that everything is fine, that there is, you know, if we have any problems, it doesn't have anything to do with racism. It's, you know, just our lack of trying. Now the part where he kind of stuck with me, stuck out to me about the zombies, just using that a lot. It says, believe me, the zombies are more terrifying than the settlers. And just going on from there, which I thought was definitely interesting. I'm assuming that the zombies, and definitely correct me if I'm wrong, he's saying zombies as if it's like, I guess, non-white people, not really just basically wandering around about, not really trying to maybe be like pacifists, I guess, not doing anything to agitate anyone or basically go along with, I guess, what he's calling the colonialists. And the last thing I wanted to mention was on 58, in my version, where it, if I'm not mistaken, he's speaking about, I guess, the colonialist bourgeoisie, where they had said, you know, give us more power. And the last sentence where it says they are violent in their words and reformist in their attitudes, that it kind of, it reminds me, I guess, of what someone might call like a liberal at times. I guess that's all I wanted to point out for now. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
The male caller who spoke up simultaneously.
Oh yeah. One other author I was reminded of was I believe Eldridge Cleaver. Specifically, I guess a book, Soul on Fire. I feel like that's a book that white people I came into contact with recommended to me. And both books, they sort of have like a lot of, as Gus said, metaphors and provocative imagery. So I don't know. I think that might be one of the reasons why white people like this book as well. It could be the descriptions and his writing style. I'll mute my line.
Interesting comparison to Eldridge Cleaver. Do we have other folks who had a hand up, who had commentary they wanted to share? Other folks with a hand up?
Happy Eric?
Yes, sir.
All right. The previous female caller explained some of the things that I was looking at in regards to zombies. I kind of noted that as well, his use of the term zombie and how, and I agree with the female caller previously about how it's probably more comparable to non-white people, that term zombie. also to, I guess, one of the things that I thought about as the previous male caller talked about on why white people recommend this book. Another thing is that, you know, he's a Marxist. I guess Frantz Fanon has Marxist leanings. So, you know, white people love black Marxists. So that's something that I thought about as well. Same thing with Eldridge Cleaver. I think he has also Marxist leaning when he was with the Black Panther Party. I guess, let me see, that was, and also too, the previous email caller talked about colonialism never existed. It's, which in my, text as well, in regards to, that's very comparable to when, people say, you know, racism doesn't exist, you know, and especially when white people say that, that's practicing racism right there. And, you know, some non-white people think that racism doesn't exist and that's just confusion. So that's very comparable to what's happening today. There was another translation that that kind of stuck out to me where in the text, I think in the audio, it says it was a quote that says government for the people. But in my text, it says power to the proletariat. So that's kind of, I mean, it's a little similar, but it's still kind of like, I don't know, it still seems kind of different. So this text has a totally different translation. And I find that this is probably one of the reasons why it's very difficult to understand this text because of the translation of this stuff. So that's all I have. I'll mute my line.
Would be interesting if we have any folks who can speak French, or I guess in this case it would be, can you read French, who've read this book in French, to kind of see exactly what the original text looks like, to see if it's, you know, sizably, notably different, what the differences are. Because I mean, sometimes one word can make a substantial difference in a text. You know, I think we've had that over the past couple of weeks, even a couple times today. Do we have other folks who had a hand up that we've not heard from? Any other folks who had a hand up that we had not heard from who had a thought they wanted to get in? Folks satisfied?
Yes.
Yes, sir. We can hear you, retired firefighter.
Oh, okay. Yes, I was just thinking that Marxism was quite popular of a thought that that can perhaps be the answer to the global system of racism, white supremacy, for some non-white people, some non-white black people also in the 50s and the 60s and in the 70s. It was quite popular. So I think I heard one of the callers mention that that's perhaps also was one of the reasons why white people would recommend the book, because they are interested in non-white people thinking that Marxism is the answer. And those are perhaps white people who practice that particular political strategy. Or at least say they do it anyway. But actually, as we all know, anything that white people actually say they do is just a shroud, unless they're being honest. And it's just a shroud for practicing racism, white supremacy. They may call themselves a Marxist or a Christian or whatever, but actually, for the most part, they're practicing white supremacy. I have, in my experiences, I have seen them always around in events of some sort of activity that's designed to encourage and or try to come up with an answer to the problem. You will see those type of white people around. So I can see that based on what one of the callers was saying, that yeah, they're very interested in non-white black people being interested in Marxism. Thank goodness for people like Dr. Welsing's, I think it was a grandmother or mother one, that kind of brought her back into a more train of thought back years ago. But in my experiences of being around them, I've always was suspect of those white people that will hang around and want to engage in conversation. But you have to, just like this book, you have to really pay attention to what they're saying. And just because they're acting nice or basically agreeing with some of the things that you have to say about racist white supremacy, ultimately they're not interested in solving the problem. Just further deceiving and or confusing non-white people. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
We miss anyone? Anyone else have a hand up with that commentary? Grand. Is the caller who I think used the term academic when describing this text in describing in terms of how it was written and maybe some of the wordiness, the verboseness of the text. Is that caller still with us who specifically used the word academic?
Yes, that was me.
All right, on. Just if you recall the context in which you use the term academic and then what you mean when you say academic?
If I can remember, I think I used the term academic format, I think, or academic style, if I can remember my commentary in regards to it.
Okay. And then in that context, I think that sounds pretty close to my recollection as well. What do you mean when you say academic format?
Well, you know, generally using words that are, you know, very, how should I put it? In a sense where it's words that are basically that are used in, I guess, in higher level education is what I guess that's what I'll use for now.
Okay. Is it accurate to say that generally speaking, when people are writing for higher level education, they're writing for predominantly white audience?
That's a good question. I would have to think about that. I guess in the term of this book, I guess I'm still, he seems like he is writing for white people, Mr. Frantz Fanon. But, you know, like the previous text that I had referenced, Dr. Tommy Curry's book, he seems to be more geared towards black people from the readings that I have so far. I've only gotten to 1/4 of his new text, so.
Right on. That is something we can think about, right, as we proceed. Answered all the questions. I appreciate it. But, yeah, that's something we can think about as we proceed through the book. Who do we think, you know, this book is written for? I would say it's been out, 50 years now, I think. Is my math correct? Yeah, it's been out 50 years now. More than 50 years. It's encroaching on 60 years. I think at this point we could look at the audience in terms of the people that have read it, people that are still talking about it. I think that, you know, could tell a lot as well. But that's something I think we should keep in mind as we proceed through the text. And I'm going to start asking, because that's a pattern that I've noted a lot of times. And this came up when Dr. Welsing passed. It was a whole lot of people who were, man, I love Dr. Welsing. She's so cool. She meant so much. She was a right-on lady. I never did get around to reading ISIS papers. Yeah, I should make time for that. And still haven't read. And I'm not, you know, whatever. It's no judgment. I'm just saying that this did happen. Might be even some people listening to this broadcast right now. I'm sure it's a whole lot of folks who revere and talk about Wretched of the Earth for people who saw Spike Lee's Bamboozled. there, the line when the Mau Maus, since that was referenced in the book this week too, the Mau Maus, the group, the Mau Maus in Bamboozled, which featured members of the Roots and MC Search, former guest on the Cows, Gano Grills, his line that opens that song is, "They lucky I ain't read Wretched yet. Haven't quite read it yet. When I get around to reading it, if I get my dictionary and can make time to get through this, man, I'm going to put it on them," almost is what it's implying. I suspect a whole lot of people that talk about Fanon have not read Wretched of the Earth, have certainly not completed it. Maybe the same is true for Black Skin, White Mask. And that's just a pattern that I've noted, that frequently we've not read these people's work. We really don't have a deep understanding of what they're saying, and that might be hampering some of our efforts to solve this problem, investing some of that time to make sure we're understanding these people that we, you know, say meant a lot to us and did some great work. Anything else folks need to get in? If not, you
can I be here?
Oh, yes, sir. Proceed.
I wanted to add also too, with in regards to, you know, Black communism and Marxism. I remember Dr. John Henry Clark, he used to be part of the Communist Party, and then he left it because of the racism that he was experiencing within that party. And then he eventually had denounced them because of the racism of the Communist Party. So that's also something to that's also something I had thought about as well.
Very important. Absolutely. I think it just reminds me when I mentioned Mr. Fuller earlier, when you don't understand racism, white supremacy, everything else will confuse you. And that happens to a lot of us. We think that it's capitalism and, you know, it's something else. It has confounded a lot of us. And whites have done a great job seeing to it that we get confused off on, you know, a whole lot of others. I'm a Marxist, I'm a Leninist, and, you know, all the rest of it. Anything else? Did we miss anybody? Anybody else? Final comment? All right. We'll be here next Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Feel free to email your commentary if you listen to the archives. We'll be here tomorrow. The compensatory call-in. We'll catch up on news observations from the past 7 days. Joseph Gibson will be back with us on Tuesday. He's been with us multiple times. He did Trapped in Rainbows. He did The Monsters We Make, about how mostly white female teachers come in and view a class of Black, brilliant girls and boys and think, oh, my God, this next generation of super predators. Got to get them in detention and everything else. Great book. He did most recently. We talked about his thesis that because of racism, white supremacy, we are suffering from brain damage because we get faulty concepts and get bombarded by terrorism, and it alters the way that we think about the world because of racism, white supremacy. He has written a new book which talks about how we set up, we being teachers, parents of Black children, we end up having a lot of racist thoughts that automatically we do not think Black children are capable of being brilliant. And unless they show it, like, immediately, like if they're not bringing home straight A's in the first, like, kindergarten, first grade, oh man, you're just going to be another dumb nigra, and, you know, whatever. That's the way we have been conditioned to see Black children. And he talks about how, you know, he started to see this pattern in parents that he was working with, educators, and ways to recognize and fight against that. That's what his new book is about. He'll be here on Tuesday to discuss. If you have problems, guest suggestions, questions, gripes, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. untiljustice@gmail.com. Thanks to all the folks for participating. Hope it was a constructive investment of your Friday evening. We'll state again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I know it is summertime. I got out, frolicked, got my sunshine in today in Seattle with our heat advisory. I think it was 89 degrees today or something like that. Enjoy, have fun. Just saying, they still are going to have enforcement officials out in full force. I do not think the evidence shows that we have done better in terms of solving these problems that Fanon is addressing with a brew or a cigarette. I've seen no evidence that that has helped us. If anything, I've seen lots of cases where these poisons have caused us a lot of extra and unnecessary problems. I think Dr. Welsing, maybe even Mr. Fanon, would encourage sobriety. Let's stay sober, keep our brain healthy and functioning at a high level so we can solve these problems and eliminate white terrorism immediately. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.